I'm Paul Lancour with PodTech.net, and right now I'm here with Paul Schopis. He's the Associate Director of Ornet. Paul, hello.
Hello.
Thanks very much for joining us. Right off the bat, perhaps you could explain to our listeners what Ornet is.
Ornet is the research and education network for the state of Ohio. We're a project of the State Board of Regents, and so we connect all of the universities in the state to the Internet and the research and education backbones that are national.
And you are a part of the Ohio State University?
Well, actually, Ohio State University acts as our fiduciary agent. We're actually a project of the State Board of Regents.
So, as such, what does Ornet do for education in the state of Ohio?
Well, basically, we provide them with their Internet connectivity, and because we're an Internet to Gigapop, we also provide services that, for example, most of the commodity providers today don't carry, such as IPv6 and multicast. And we also support jumbo frames.
And that's for not just the higher education in the state of Ohio, but that's for all of education in the state of Ohio?
That part of it is just for higher education. Ornet also runs a thing called the TFN, the Third Frontier Network, which is a facilities-based optical network. So we actually run all of the optical services for K-12 as well, but we don't run their IP service.
So is there a way that you can give us an idea of what the breadth of clients is that you serve, how many people are involved?
Basically, as far as our IP services, we support, right now we have 88 colleges and universities online, and we estimate our downstream users about 2.5 million.
So that's a vast number of people with a vast array of needs from the network. I would imagine that would create some special problems for you when setting up a network.
Well, it does to some degree. I mean, we have, just to give you an idea, our largest university in the state is the Ohio State University, and their undergraduate population is about 55,000 right now. They're one of the largest universities in the world. And our smallest college is a rabbinical college down in Cincinnati that has 12 students. So there's quite a variety of needs and services that people need.
So what are some of the specific problems that you face when trying to build out a network like that?
Well, basically, our biggest problem today has been, and it probably kind of really ties into our routing architecture, is that in the state we have 10 schools that are regular members of Internet 2, and those are usually, in almost every case, is a large state school, with the exception of Case Western, which is a private college. And so then I have another 27 or 28 schools that are what's called a SEGP participant in the Internet 2 program. So those schools have access to the resources that Internet 2 provides. The rest of the schools don't have that access, so it really creates, that's probably one of the harder things we do here, is that we have to create a routing environment where the schools that have access to Abilene and Internet 2 get that access and those services, and the schools that are not entitled to them don't get them.
And Ornet was founded in 1987, is that right?
Correct.
How long have you been with Ornet?
I've been with Ornet 10 years.
And so that entire time, I imagine you've seen a lot of changes in not only the technology, but in, you know, what you've had to do in terms of building that network and the demands on it.
Well, for example, when I first started with the organization, I was a field engineer. And actually, about the first year or two I worked for Ornet, I was putting in T1 lines for schools. And back in those days, kind of sounds funny to say that, but back in those days, you know, T1 was considered high capacity. We would get the high cap services center when we were having problems. So today, to give you an idea, you know, we've in our backbone, since we run our own backbone at this point, we're currently deploying 10 gigabit services. So it's millions and millions of times faster than what I originally worked with.
And what role has Juniper played in building out this network?
Well, Juniper solved a really very specific problem that we had. Going back to what I was talking about, having to kind of split our traffic up and who's eligible for what service, that kind of a scenario is commonly referred to in the routing world as the fish problem. And what Juniper allowed us to do is, because they have an implementation of logical routers, we're able to create, using one physical chassis, a logical router that actually serviced their Internet 2 clients, that we could then have separate instances of BGP and separate routing tables, and we basically paste all that together to get it to the right head end by using MPLS. So basically what that allows us to do is, right on the edge, we do all this kind of filtering and marking, and the logical router also acts as the PE router for the MPLS function, and we'll go ahead and tag the packet so that when it hits the core, all the router has to do in the core. It doesn't have to understand very many rules. If it's got an MPLS pat or an MPL shim in the header, it goes ahead and uses the LFIB. If it doesn't, then it just uses a standard IP routing table, and that's how we're able to make that all work.
Why is this called the fish problem?
Actually, historically, I wasn't at the meeting, but back when these kinds of scenarios were starting to evolve, particularly in the higher education space for the regional networks like we are, someone was drawing the problem, and it kind of vaguely, I suppose if you had enough beer, it probably helped, but it kind of vaguely resembled the Christian's fish symbol. Mm-hmm. And for some reason, somebody said, hey, that looks like the fish. And so
it stuck.
It kind of stuck. So it's commonly referred to as the fish problem.
So looking back over the 10 years that you've been with Auranet, I imagine it would have been difficult to predict where you would be today in terms of the ability of technology and what the demands on you would be. And I'm wondering if you could have anticipated this 10 years down the road, and maybe looking 10 years ahead from here, where you think this kind of networking challenge will go.
Oh, okay. Well, I would say 10 years ago, no, I couldn't even begin to imagine what we're doing these days. Back in those days, I said it was all T1, it was all strictly IP. The data rates were much, much lower. Things such as multicast were a real struggle. It's pretty commonplace these days. Looking out toward the future, I tend to think that we probably will continue to see network virtualization. In other words, the way we're using logical routers today, there's a lot of research projects that are taking place at the national and international level that there's a notion that we'll have virtualization in both, not only, for example, like in servers today in data centers, but you'll actually have routers that have provisionable sections that allow a user to, on the fly, grab a resource, as well as on the fly, very dynamic network building. So that, say, for example, you have a multi-lambda network that has a certain number of the lambdas are in use all the time, as they are today, but you have some set aside and reserved for special occasions. So say, for example, if there's a special project that needs a very, very high data exchange between a couple of, say, supercomputer clusters, that you would on the fly crank up using GMPLS or some morally equivalent mechanism. I think GMPLS is the leader right now in the game, but would basically crank up those resources. And the real tipping point today for that kind of a technology happening really is just pricing. I think as components in the optical world tend to continue to come down, things like that will start to become fiscally practical. I think there's a lot of logical and research reasons one would want to do that today. I think what prevents people from doing more of it is the expense involved. But as optics and multiplexers become commoditized, that just like 10 gigabit Ethernet, using an analogy here, just look at the way the prices have come down, and because of that price shift, 10 gigabit Ethernet's becoming very commonplace at this point. So I think, you know, looking toward the future, we'll see that kind of a thing going on.
I'm wondering if the reason that the prices have come down on some of those things and will continue in the future is because of the laws that are associated with such things, with the speeds of delivery just doubling and doubling, or is it also because people's expectations are such that the market is driving this kind of innovation?
It's a little bit of both. I think the expectation drives it, and as soon as the business case gets to be made. I mean, for example, a 10 gigabit transfer, even in the Sonnet world at OC192, became a reality when the price point to install OC192 started to become a better deal than deploying four OC48s. So similarly, that's happened in the gigabit world of Ethernet, and I think similarly, well, for example, I mean, the optics are coming down dramatically in price, and a lot of it is simply, you know, supply and demand. There's enough of a demand to drive people to produce such mechanisms. For example, today, one can even buy a ITU grid specific SPF for a router or a switch, and that's basically colored, a reserved piece of band frequency, rather, of light that they're getting terribly inexpensive, you know, on the order of like $300 to $500. I mean, to put it in perspective, 3 years ago when we built the network, a part like that was selling for about four times that.
And I imagine that, yeah, as you say, those prices will continue to come down and yep. Things will get faster and faster.
Yep.
Thanks for taking the time out of your schedule to speak with us today, Paul.
Have a good day.
Paul Schopis is the Associate Director of Auranet.